on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/spiritualshow. That's the name of the channel, Spiritual Show. And I do have a website, spiritualshow.com, but it totally needs an overhaul. So you may as well just visit me on YouTube, and then you can see my dorky new glasses and lots of interviews. And you can always send me a message that way. So today we are going to be speaking with Madeline Somerville. She is the author of All You Need Is Less, The Eco-Friendly Guide to Guilt-Free Green Living and Stress-Free Simplicity. And Madeline Somerville adores writing in all its incarnations and has a popular blog at sweetmadeline.ca. She has a BA in sociology and became an unrepentant tree-hugging hippie after moving to British Columbia 8 years ago. But now she's living in Edmonton with her husband, Adam, and her just two-year-old daughter now, Olive, and their dog, Gus. Welcome to the show, Madeline.
Hi, Marie. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. So I was looking at your blog, sweetmadeline.com, or sorry, .ca. If you go to .com, it's about a dog, but sweetmadeline.ca. And your daughter just had her second birthday.
I know. We're all kind of coming down from cupcake highs and birthday chaos. We had the party yesterday, so I've officially got a two-year-old.
Aww. Well, I wanted to start off the conversation talking about your daughter just because there's so many. I mean, you were just writing about it on your blog, and I loved the insights that you had about, you know, how she was when she was a baby. You thought this was the greatest thing ever. And now that she's two, you're like, how can it even get any better? So I imagine with eco-friendly living, you really are planning to have a better planet for our children. I mean, that's really what it's all about, is the next generation, and we want to keep the planet clean for them. So tell us about your experience with pregnancy and writing this book as well.
Well, it was a very interesting experience, because as soon as you get pregnant, you start looking at the lists. You feel like this need to prepare. And so you start looking at all the lists of what you need, and they just seem to be endless. And all of them are different. And one person's must-have item is the other person's never-used-it item. And it all can be so overwhelming. And it really took sort of, even from before Olive was born, we really had to take a look at what we wanted her life to be like, because we were planning for it even before she got here. So it did involve a lot of thinking about what world we wanted to create for her, both in the macro sense of we would like there to be, you know, trees and nature and clean water and all these things that parents hope for. I hope that she grows up in the same world that we were able to, but also on a really micro level, like what did we want her home to look like? What did we want her toys? What kind of toys did we want her playing with? What lotions were we going to use on her, not use? Like there was a million different decisions, but being able to approach it from an attitude of examining what was best for the earth and what was best for her, there was huge overlap. Oftentimes, you know, what was best for her was often more eco-friendly as well. It made it a little bit easier to make those decisions, and it really informed how we prepared for her. So we did a lot of secondhand shopping. We bought virtually everything for her secondhand, and still do. I still both buy most of her clothes secondhand and most of her toys as well. And so it definitely informed how we made a lot of parenting decisions. And it still does. Even at her birthday over the weekend, we used real plates instead of plastic or paper plates. And we had, you know, those big paper poofy pom-pom things instead of balloons. Like, we make a lot of decisions like that. Because I think it is a responsibility to kind of raise her like that, but also to show her that it can be fun. It is not this drab, you know, sterile environment where you don't have any fun and everything is, you know, threadbare and you have to use it a million times. But it's just something that she'll grow up and think is normal until she's a teenager and rebels and throws everything out the window, of course.
So where do you even begin with all of this? Can you tell us about how you came to be this tree-hugging hippie?
Long, long journey. I mean, it was a long process. I think if I had tried to go from one extreme to the other in a few days or a few weeks, I would have gone absolutely insane. But it was a slow process. And I think it started actually when we got our puppy, Gus. We've got this huge English Mastiff puppy. And I remember bringing him home, and he came home and he started licking our kitchen floors. And I remember thinking that I had just mopped those floors with this fluorescent cleaner that I was using at the time. It was literally fluorescent yellow and had this super strong smell, which I liked because it reminded people that I had cleaned. Like if they came in, you immediately were like, oh, Madeline has just mopped her floors. How good of her. But it kind of connected the dots for me, seeing our puppy licking this floor and realizing that he was ingesting this stuff that had warning labels all over it. And I don't know why, but that's the first time that it really connected with me, that I had no idea what was in the products that I was using in my home and on my body. And that's where it all started for me. And I started switching my cleaners and my body care products to more natural, earth-friendly stuff. And then that became a whole wormhole in itself, because what does that mean? What does natural mean? There was a ton of label reading going on, and I would buy something and then find out that it wasn't green, that it was just being marketed that way, which was so frustrating. And eventually that led to me just making stuff myself and realizing that I could make things like laundry detergent on my own, which I had no conception that that was even a possibility. And so once I started doing that, I mean, that was just the beginning of everything. I realized that I could make basically everything myself, and I knew exactly what was in it, and I could change it up if I wanted. I could make it smell different or be less soapy or more soapy, and it just kind of went from there. That's where I started.
So, Madeline, I'm curious with I'm having like brain problems today. I don't know. I can't formulate my questions.
It is Monday.
It is. So I'm curious, what do you use instead of the floor cleaner?
Well, to clean my floors, I mean, you can really go a million different ways with it. And if you wanted to be super basic, you could just use an eco-friendly dish detergent and some water, like just a tiny bit of dish detergent and some water, get a cloth. Like really the best way to mop your floors is to get down on your hands and knees with a cloth and do it. And it really doesn't take that much time. It feels so old school, but I find that that's the best way just because you can actually see what you're doing. Sometimes when you're mopping, you're not really seeing what you're getting and what you're missing. But oftentimes I dump some vinegar in there as well, just to kind of deodorize and do some grease fighting as well. And then we moved into a new house recently that has these beautiful old hardwood floors. And I sometimes use tea on those, which really helps because the tannic acid sort of conditions them and removes a little bit of the grime, but it doesn't damage the surface of it. So you just can really play around with a bunch of different things. It doesn't have to be complicated. That's what I've realized, is that you look around and there's a million different recipes and there's like 8 different ingredients and you have to measure things. But if you really wanted to be super simple about it, all you need to clean something is soap. And that's what dish soap is. And, you know, if you really wanted to get really basic with it, just do a bit of that and water and you're good to go.
Now, you use that Dr. Brenner's, or I don't know.
Dr. Bronner's. Yeah, I love that stuff.
Is that because soap, I mean, sometimes you see on the label, like it's biodegradable. How do you know whether soap is okay or not?
Well, a lot of soaps, there tend to be 2 different types of soaps, some that use animal fats and some that use vegetable fats. And castile soap is vegetable-based, so it's usually an olive oil or castor oil base. And that just tends to be a little bit more gentle and easier, you know, aside from the fact that if you were vegan or something, you wouldn't necessarily want to be using something with animal fats. And then there's also ones that are detergent-based, and that's sometimes what you get in the store-bought soaps. And that's why if you ever use, like, just a bar soap, it can leave your skin feeling really tight because that is that detergent base that's really stripping the oils from your skin. So if you use a natural bar soap, it'll usually have, like, an oil base, which is a little bit more moisturizing. But Dr. Bronner's is great. It's so gentle. It comes in a million different scents. If you wanted a scent to it, they're all from essential oils, so you don't have to worry about weird stuff being incorporated in the fragrance. But it's a really great just all-purpose soap. You know, I use it on my daughter's hair. You can use it for floors. You can use it for basically anything.
Cool. Do you use anything, pink solution or anything like that? Have you heard of it?
I have a big tub of pink solution because somebody was telling me that it was crazy and it worked on everything. And I bought it a few years ago and I think I tried it and I could never find out what was in it. I haven't been able to find any information on what the ingredients are. And it says that it's biodegradable and natural, but that's one of those questions that I was like, I don't even know where to go to access information about what this is, because everything is biodegradable eventually, right? Like even plastic in 5 million years will biodegrade. So I just kind of wasn't sure where to go with that when I still have it. So if anyone has any information, let me know and then I can start using it again.
Cool. Yeah, I have some and I don't know what's in it either. Supposedly enzymes or something.
It's the problem, is it like when somebody finds something like that that works really well, they want to protect it, but then people like me are like, but what is it? What is it?
Well, I'm curious, what's wrong with bleach? Because I know it's really like strong smelling and it can burn off your skin and everything, but it's just like one element, right? Isn't chlorine bleach? I don't know how it works. But
the concerns for me are mostly, a lot of our society is built on the idea that it's out of sight, out of mind. But everything that we use in the shower or in our laundry or in our dishwashers, it all goes down the drain and ends up in our water systems. And so the issue with bleach, aside from, it's a bit toxic in that if somebody, if a little person in your house found it and ingested it, that's really, really serious and could cause serious harm. Same thing, if you spill it, you're going to bleach whatever you... I used to have big bleach spots on my bedroom carpet in my house growing up because my sister spilled bleach. And like, it's kind of like this, you have to really handle it with a lot of care and make sure it's locked up when you're not using it. But then, when you use it, it's being washed down the drain and it's ending up somewhere. And all of these chemical solutions that we're using are being washed down our drains and they're being filtered out and they have to go somewhere. Like, they don't just disappear. So the reason that I choose more natural and friendly items is that, A, I don't have to worry about locking up my cabinets. I don't have those, like, countertop locks or anything like that, because if my daughter gets into vinegar, I mean, big deal. She's going to, I don't know if she'll like the taste, but it's not going to kill her. And then, baking soda, if it gets washed down the drain, not really a big deal. It's a really basic solution that's not going to harm anything if it comes in contact with it. And I find that, it's fantastic that we have these awesome sewage systems and plumbing systems and garbage collection, not bashing that at all. I would not want to have a landfill in my backyard. But it's sometimes a bad thing because we forget that it all goes somewhere and it has to sit there until it decomposes eventually in thousands of years. So we kind of end up with this out of sight, out of mind mentality when it doesn't disappear. It has to go somewhere.
But unless you have a filter on your tap, we're all drinking bleach every day, aren't we?
Yeah, I don't know how much, it all gets filtered out, and the water that we drink from the tap does have to pass, really stringent standards to actually be reconstituted and be drinkable. But I think someone was telling me that they were doing studies in the UK or something about trace amounts of birth control and drug products being in water, just because, the minute amounts that they can filter out, everything just gets recirculated back, so... I don't know, it just ends up being this sort of chemical stew. And even when it does get filtered out, it still has to be put somewhere. So I don't know. When I started thinking about this kind of thing, it can sometimes seem really overwhelming because you look at what's being put out there and then what tiny thing you're doing, and it seems like it doesn't really have much effect. But I think that you just kind of have to take it by what you can control. And, don't worry about your 18 neighbors who are using bleach or, throwing everything in the garbage instead of recycling, and just take it as what you can do to stop it. Because any small change that you make is going to have an effect. It is going to grow and take on those positive effects, regardless of what anyone else is doing.
All right. That is a point I wanted to bring up, is the fact that when you see other people not taking care of the environment, it almost feels like, well, why bother?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And everyone has felt this way, right? Like, even somebody who wants to make these changes might not have a spouse or a roommate or a coworker or a family member that's as excited. And it's pretty rare, I find, that two people are all gung-ho right at the same time. It seems like generally one person takes the lead. And sometimes it can be hard to convince people to do what you're doing, especially when some of it is kind of weird. Like, if you're living in an apartment and you want to start composting, you might get a worm compost and your roommate's like, why are there worms in our kitchen? Like, this is not cool. It does sometimes take a little bit to get people on board. And I talk about that a little bit in the book, because I had that struggle with my husband. I kept trying these weird eco-friendly things, and some would work and some wouldn't. But even the ones, everyone I tried, it was sort of this raised eyebrow and like, what are you doing now? And the ones that didn't work just sort of ended up being this weird catastrophe, and we would have fights over the compost I was keeping in our freezer. And, it doesn't always... not this perfect road to green living, and that's okay. So I talk about how to temper your approach so that you're not an enviro-nag, because you don't want to turn into that person. And we've all, I think I've been that person for sure. I hope I'm not anymore, but I probably slide into it every now and again just because I'm excited about it. But you don't want to be that person who nobody wants to hang out with because they're so worried about being criticized. You know, if a friend invited me for coffee and she used like a disposable cup, I'm not going to launch into a lecture about how many millions of trees are cut down every year just for disposable coffee cups and blah, blah, blah. Like, nobody wants to have a coffee date that starts like that, right? I don't think I'd have very many friends left. So it's just sort of tempering that approach and not, you know, just choosing to lead with enthusiasm and be excited about the stuff that you are doing. And then if other people are interested, they'll ask, right? You don't need to start giving this lecture to a question that was never asked. If they want to start doing what you're doing, they'll ask. And at that point, it's really cool to share your knowledge and to kind of give those secrets away and all the stuff that you're doing and that you're loving. But before that point, it might be good just to step down off your soapbox and just take care of yourself. You can only control what you're doing.
That's such a good point, because the more you preach about it, the more turned off people are going to be.
Oh yeah. And like my husband is the perfect example of that. The more I push him towards one thing, the harder he digs in his heels and like almost ends up going in the opposite direction. So he was like my test case for dealing with my approach on this, is if I felt resistance from him, I was like, okay, I'm being too naggy. I'm being too ridiculous. Calm down, Madeline. take it down a notch. So he was really good for teaching me that lesson for sure. Because nobody likes to feel judged. Nobody likes to feel like somebody is thinking that they're a horrible person. And recycling doesn't make you a better person. It just makes you somebody who recycles, right? Like my mom gave me this bag, this reusable shopping bag that said, "This cloth bag makes me better than you." And that was kind of like summed up the whole situation right there of what this eco-friendly living had kind of become. So that's why I wanted to approach this book with a really tongue-in-cheek tone and make light of it rather than making it this holier-than-thou, huge, depressing issue.
Well, it's interesting, and I appreciate that, because it is the whole bag with the "this makes me better than you" reminds me, it's like sounds like a South Park episode or something. But you were talking about coffee earlier, and it made me think of back in like the 80s and maybe the early 90s. I remember going, not that I was buying coffee in the 80s, but, you know, I remember you'd go to a place and they would say, "Would you like that for here or to go?"
Mm-hmm.
And now when I go to Starbucks or a coffee shop, they don't even ask me that. They just give me a to-go cup automatically.
Yeah. And you can specifically, if you go to a Starbucks or most coffee shops, probably not all, but most of them, if you go to them and say, "I'd like that to stay," they will give you a mug. But yeah, you have to specifically ask for it. And if you don't remember, or if you're in conversation or whatever, you forget, they automatically give you a paper cup. And it's crazy. Like, you go and you look around any Starbucks, everyone is sitting there, like obviously staying at the cafe, chatting or working or whatever they're doing, and they've all got disposable cups. It's crazy. I don't know when that shifted, probably when it became so busy, because of course it's less time for them. They don't have to ask, they just do it. And then it's less time washing the dishes. But oh my God, those garbage bins by the front door are just overflowing with cups that have been used for maybe 15 minutes. Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah. And it's, well, now they have a little bit, you can recycle some of them, but I see people, the recycling bin is 2 feet away from the garbage and they're still throwing in the garbage. So, but
this is the thing, is we're so like, and myself included, I'm using this as a general we, but we are so lazy. Like, human beings are just an inherently lazy species, I think. And this is where we use a lot of our intelligence, is to make life easier for ourselves. And if we don't make recycling easy or make living an eco-friendly life easy, it's really not going to happen for a lot of people. And this is why the push towards things like curbside recycling and curbside composting are so important, because you really have to make it almost easier than what they were doing before. Otherwise, you'll have that select group that goes out of their way to do something eco-friendly. But for a lot of people, whether it's they don't have the time, or they don't have the interest, or they just don't really care, they're not going to do it if it requires extra effort. So that's why a lot of the recipes that I provide are things that can be easily found at the supermarket. You don't have to go to a special store to find it, because I found that even the recipes that I would make that were fantastic and that worked really well, if they required half an hour of driving to this one random store that I could find this one particular ingredient, it wasn't sustainable for me. I wasn't going to keep doing it. So I needed it to be really easy with accessible ingredients and something that was going to be just as easy as going and buying it from the store. And I think that's true of a lot of things. If you don't make it easy for people, it sometimes isn't going to last.
Mm-hmm. And there has to be a personal reward, I think, for us to really keep up a habit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does have to become a habit. It takes a lot of discipline at the beginning, and then it's just like brushing your teeth. It starts to become a habit. But let's talk about some of the benefits that you have experienced, like time savings, money savings, health. What kind of effects are you having from eco-friendly living?
I mean, I think the first one that's really noticeable is just the amount of strange things that I'm using on my body. And if you looked at your normal daily routine in the morning and you laid out all the products that you used, women especially, we use so many products with makeup and hair stuff and everything. If you laid them all out on a countertop and wrote down all of the ingredients that were in each one, I mean, you would have like 3 pages of ingredients, and I bet you would recognize maybe a handful of them. And so for a lot of women, you leave the house in the morning and you've already put 100 different chemical compounds on your body that you aren't quite sure what they are. The beauty industry is not hugely well regulated, and you're walking around with that stuff absorbing into your skin all day. And, you know, when you shower at the end of the day, again, it's going down the drain. The product packaging has to be disposed of. It's just this big, you know, schmozzle. Whereas if you are starting your day and you're shampooing your hair with baking soda, that's like one ingredient, and you're conditioning your hair with lemon juice or apple cider vinegar, that's 2 ingredients, and then if you're using a natural body lotion made of olive oil and beeswax, that's like 3 more. So you can get out of the house with, you know, maybe a dozen ingredients, 6 of which you have on hand and you've made. It just really simplifies the amount of stuff that you're ingesting and that you're absorbing through your skin, and you're simplifying the amount of things that you're contributing back into the environment. The packaging is also a lot more eco-friendly. You're getting stuff in boxes and like big plastic containers. Like vinegar comes in a huge plastic jug as opposed to little plastic bottles that use way more. And then, of course, there's financial savings as well. And this is important because sometimes we get this trendy, eco-friendly lifestyle that seems like it costs a lot of money to do it. Like there's sort of this impression that eco-friendly living is something that you can only do if you have a ton of time or a ton of money, which is so not true. And I really wanted to emphasize that fact, because if you go and you buy eco-friendly cleaners, for some reason they end up being 2 to 3 times the price of conventional cleaners, which drives me nuts, because it shouldn't be a luxury to be eco-friendly. But you can make your own for literally pennies, like baking soda, vinegar, borax washing soda, that Dr. Bronner's, like when you average it out per use, it's literally pennies. So it doesn't have to be pricey either. So there's huge financial savings. And then just simplicity. I mean, if you've got a handful of ingredients that you're using to make everything from your shampoo and your conditioner to your lotion to your floor cleaner to your laundry detergent, your life is just so much simpler. You have more space in your cupboards. You've got more space on your shelves. Your cupboards aren't cluttered up with all of these millions of different cleaning products, because you can mix and match them all from those ingredients that you have. So it's just a, sort of a simpler life, and a life with less, but in a really good way.
Awesome.
Support the women of the Downtown East Side and spring into the Scotiabank Charity Challenge on June 24th. Join the Downtown East Side Women's Center in crowdsourcing funds and spreading awareness of their organization, which provides safe space, emergency shelter, basic essentials, and a continuum of support to marginalized women. Go to www.dewc.ca/run-4-DEWC for more information.
Damascus returns for its 4th year. Join us on July 31st as this fundraiser brings the soul of Syria to the heart of Vancouver with music, storytelling, dancing, wine, and food. All proceeds go to support queer Syrian refugees. For more information and tickets, visit eveningindamascus.com.
Well, we are speaking with Madeline Somerville right now. She is the author of All You Need Is Less, the eco-friendly guide to guilt-free green living and stress-free simplicity. You can find her at sweetmadeline.ca. That's her blog, and there's lots of tips there as well. So I wanted to ask you about some recipes. You were mentioning the washing your hair with baking soda. So what is that? Like, can you run us through the whole experience? How is it different than shampoo?
Yeah, this is the one I get asked about the most, and I actually really miss BC for this because BC has such wonderful soft water, and when I moved to Edmonton, I really had to tinker with this recipe, and I now have to boil the water before I mix my shampoo and conditioner, but I love it so much that I'm still doing that because I can't go back to shampoo, but it's really, really simple, and it seems like it shouldn't work because it's almost too simple, and as women, most of us spend a ridiculous amount on shampoo and conditioner because we're, like, very emotionally attached to our hair. It can be a very huge part of our identity, and we don't want to mess with it, but I just encourage everybody to try this because oftentimes it'll work, and you'll love it, and your shower routine will be so much easier and way less expensive, too. So the recipe is so easy. All you're doing for the shampoo rinse is that you're mixing 1 tablespoon of baking soda in with 1 cup of warm water. So you're just going to dump the baking soda in, stir it up until it's really well dissolved, and then hop in the shower. And once your hair is wet, just pour that onto your scalp. It's not going to foam or bubble like a normal shampoo would, but you're just going to basically massage it into your scalp. If you've got oily hair, I would concentrate along the hairline and the crown of your head because that's where it tends to be a little bit oilier. Give yourself a nice little scalp massage and then rinse it all out, rinse it really well. And that's your shampoo rinse, and that's all you need. And for your conditioning rinse, you can either add 1 to 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar or lemon juice. If apple cider vinegar smell bugs you, you can do the lemon juice instead. So 1 to 2 tablespoons of that into, again, a cup of warm water. And once the baking soda is all rinsed out of your hair, you pour that conditioning rinse through. And I usually just tie my hair up and leave it for a few minutes like you would with normal conditioner, and you can shave your legs or exfoliate or whatever else you need to get done. Rinse that out. And then, you know, just hop out of the shower and style how you normally would. I just find it incredible because you can brush your hair right away. It's, like, completely smooth and tangle-free. Sometimes people report having an adjustment period, like needing a few washes for their hair to get used to it. But for me, from the moment I used it, I loved it. My hair was super light and fluffy and so, so soft. And you don't smell from the apple cider vinegar. Like, if you use that, you're not going to smell like fish and chips or salad dressing after. It doesn't smell when it's dry. And it's just really simple. I don't know. I just always tell people, I know it sounds crazy, but just try it and see what you think. If it doesn't work, no harm done. You can just go back to what you were doing before, but totally try it. I think you'll be amazed.
Now, Madeline, you have straight hair, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So what about, because I have to put in a whole whack of conditioner and then pick it out in the shower when it's wet, and then, like, it's a whole process.
Because you've got curly hair, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I had a friend who had super curly hair, and she would skip the baking soda part of it and just do the conditioning part. Like, she would use her normal shampoo and then just use the apple cider vinegar as conditioner. But that's why I say everyone just try it, because there are so many different hair types. And mine is fairly, like, low-maintenance hair. It's just straight, blah hair. Like, I, like most straight-haired women, look at curly-haired women and they're like, I want your hair. Sometimes vice versa, I'm sure. But I think just try it and see, because I'm not, like, my friend really liked it and that method worked for her. So sometimes you just kind of have to, like, tinker around and see what works. But I would say just experiment. Become my guinea pig and then report back.
All right. Well, let's talk about the beg, barter, and borrow.
Yeah, so this is a method that I talk about because a huge thing that I focus on in this book comes back to the title, All You Need Is Less. And it's focusing on the reducing part of the environmental movement because this is something that's gotten a little bit lost. We talk about the 3 R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. But we've kind of forgotten the first one because it can't be marketed very well. Companies can't really sell the idea of reducing because it means you're not buying anything and that doesn't help them. So it's kind of gotten ignored, but it's the first one for a reason. It's because it's the most important one. And although it's fantastic to be able to recycle things, it's far better for the environment if you don't have something to recycle in the first place. So I always talk about the first place that you can start being eco-friendly, even if you didn't want to make your own shampoo, if you didn't want to buy second hand clothing, if you didn't want to do any of this stuff, if you could reduce the amount that you're buying, it would have a huge impact. And that's a really simple step that you can take if you don't want to get into the rest of this stuff. But one idea that I threw out there is the idea of communal property and begging, borrowing, and bartering rather than buying something for ourselves. And this is something that kind of has gone a little bit out of use because it's so easy to buy things. We have credit cards. We have stores that are, you know, open all hours, and you can buy basically anything you need. So there doesn't really seem to be a reason to do without. And we look at possessions as treats or rewards when they actually are responsibilities, right? They take up space in our homes. We have to clean them. We have to maintain them. We have to dispose of them when they break. So if we can look at reducing our possessions, not as something that's doing without. It's not like you're on a diet and you're all hungry all the time. It's like you're freeing yourself from the responsibility of owning those things. And look at maybe sharing property instead. So if you want a food dehydrator, maybe find a friend who's also into that, and you guys can go in on one together and then just share it back and forth, because you're not going to be using it every day. Or like for my daughter's birthday, I went to Value Village and I got a whole bunch of old lady plates with like the flowers and the gold rims, and they were, I don't know, 25 cents to a dollar each. And I picked up about 15 or 20 of them. And now I have those on hand for whenever I have a party, and I can share those with my brother who lives in town, and my friends, whoever has a party, can borrow those so that we don't have to go out and buy paper or plastic plates. And it can go really for anything. Like if you don't have space to garden, maybe you could trade a chore to your neighbor and she could give you some of the stuff that she's growing. Like this kind of network of borrowing things and asking for things and lending things kind of makes people nervous sometimes because we've gotten out of the habit of it. But it forms those relationships and those networks between our neighbors and between our friends. And it means that you can spend a lot less, you can own a lot less, and then that money can go towards having vacations or buying experiences rather than paying for stuff that just sits cluttering up our garage and we use it once or twice a year.
There's so many, okay, so all of these thoughts that I want to talk about, because there's so many great points in your book. But speaking of the responsibility of having stuff, like I'm starting to get away from buying myself a trinket or accepting, like, do you want this? No, because it's just going to be in my house, take up more space.
Mm-hmm.
But that brings up the whole Christmas thing, which is just around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, I've actually started to resent Christmas because I've started to see it now as just exchanging plastic crap that nobody wants. Mm-hmm. I don't want your plastic crap. I don't want to spend my money on buying plastic junk for you either that you don't need. So how do you still participate in the Christmas spirit without all the garbage?
It's so true. Like Christmas is just this looming financial burden of stress and mall chaos for so many people. And it was getting that way for us too, because I have 5 siblings. My husband has 2, and then they have spouses and children and our parents and our friends. And although, I mean, having too many people to buy gifts for is really a fantastic problem to have, it's also unbelievably expensive. Like we were looking at something like 26 gifts. And at that point, you're just wandering through a mall, picking up random crap and thinking, this will do, and then like checking that person off your list. And that's not the experience that I wanted to have. And that's not, I didn't want to be just somebody on somebody's list that they felt like they had to find some random piece of crap for. Like, I didn't want that. So a few years ago, we started looking at, thankfully, Adam's family and my family are both really on the same page about this. And we started doing Secret Santa gift exchanges. So this is just among the adults. We'd still do gifts for the children. But we put everybody's name in a hat. So all of my family members and their spouses' names go in a hat, and we pick one name for each person. So now instead of buying 12 gifts, I buy one. And same for my husband's family. Instead of buying, you know, 8 gifts, we buy one. And it's so, so simple. It makes things so much easier. And it also means that we can put so much more thought into that one gift. So rather than buying a bunch of little gifts for $20 or $30 each, we can buy one. And the limit is usually between $80 and $100. And if you're spending that kind of money, you can really put some thought into it about what does this person need? What would fulfill them? What would bring them joy? What would really help out a hobby that they're doing? And you get to spend so much time thinking about that one gift that is not a piece of crap anymore. And same with you. You're getting something back that you really, really want and that is really well made, it's good quality, and it's not kind of like, oh, random fuzzy socks, thanks. Like, it just simplifies things so much. But you're also still celebrating the holiday. You don't have to feel like a Scrooge. And for kids, we sort of, before my daughter was born, set out this limit that we really would prefer secondhand stuff and that we would prefer things that were not made of plastic. And that was so helpful, because if you walk into a toy store and you look around and you take out all the things that are made with plastic, you have like four toys to choose from. And that's kind of helpful because it cuts down on the amount of crap that comes into your home, because people just immediately know that they can't buy that. And she has received some plastic things over the years, but we use them as bath toys and they're graciously received. You don't ever want to turn away a gift. It's so thoughtful of somebody to put that energy into it. But for the most part, we've avoided that. And because toys made of wood or cloth or felt are tend to be handmade, they are more expensive, which I think is a good thing, because that means you only get one as opposed to 18. And so she just has one toy that she can play with from that one person rather than five different gifts, because they were so inexpensive.
And for kids, I really like toys that spark the imagination and like blocks and things where you're actually learning and developing your brain, because so many of these things in the store, they are more entertained by the package half the time than the toy.
Yeah. And they're so specific. Like, it's like, here's this pizza set, and it's a really cute little pizza set, but you can only make a pizza with it, right? Whereas if you gave them like a coloring book, or another idea I really like for kids is to give them an experience rather than a gift. And this is like a gift for the parents and for the child. So if you're a long distance relative, find out what attractions are in the town or the city that that child is living in, and give them a pass to the zoo or a pass to the museum or a pass to the science center. Because oftentimes these are things that parents really want to take their kids to, but you take three or four kids to the zoo and that's $150 a day. Like, that's so pricey. Whereas if you can give them a pass to it, that kind of relieves that financial obligation. And if you're in town, you can take them. Take your little toddler nephew to the park for the day, or take them out for a fancy dinner, just you and them. And that's something that you're creating an experience. You're not buying a possession that the parents are going to have to deal with and store in their home and trip over for 3 weeks. But you're creating an experience that that child is going to remember. And it's also kind of a break for the parents. Like, it's like free babysitting. Take the kid off my hands for a few hours. So if you can buy experiences for people rather than gifts, and I mean, adults too, give me a manicure rather than, you know, something else. And I mean, that's something that I'm going to love.
I love that idea. But if you're angry at them, you can always buy the child a drum set or something really loud.
Something with lots of batteries and repetitive noises. Yeah, always appreciate it. I think I was that person before I had kids. I was like, here, have a xylophone. Oh, good old Auntie Maddie.
Yeah. You were talking earlier when we were talking about the beg, barter, and borrow and the reducing. And, you know, one of the reasons that we don't tend to focus so much on reducing is because it's not marketed. It's interesting how the media has really changed our view. Like, in this present day, when things are getting pretty dire, we do need to reduce, reuse, and recycle. It's starting to become almost mandatory if we as a species are going to survive. And yet we have more packaging now than ever before. We're consuming more and more and more. And I think part of that is because of the media, advertising, television, where you used to, even on television shows, you would borrow hedge clippers from your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And they would joke about that you'd never get them back. But now we don't borrow. We just buy our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know where this came from and where it shifted, but it is something where owning something is a really prestige thing right now. And, I mean, it used to be, when you think about somebody who was poor back in the Great Depression or back, you know, even 50 years ago, you knew they were poor because they didn't have much, right? You would go into their house and they would have a bed, a table, you know, three spoons, and like they would have very few possessions, and that's how you knew that they were poor. Nobody has few possessions in North America these days. Like, you don't go into anyone's home and find that level of scarcity, regardless if they're poor or wealthy or anything. We all have so much stuff because it's all so inexpensive and it's just marketed so that we have to have it. And a huge part of this is advertising. And I noticed this when maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we decided that we would cut off our cable. And within a few months, it was shocking to me when I would go back and watch TV at a friend's house, the advertisements, like every, you know, 15 minutes or something, you'd have that commercial break. And every single advertisement is telling you that you're not good enough. Your teeth are not white enough. Your clothes aren't clean enough. Your hair isn't shiny enough. Your kids aren't going to school with interesting lunches, your car is old, your lawn, like every single product has to tell you that you're not good enough so that you want to buy their product. And it's so pervasive and it's just everywhere that getting yourself away from that as much as possible does so much to break that cycle of consuming and that cycle of feeling like you need things. And it can be absolutely overwhelming because it's so ingrained. I mean, there was a movement to start a buy nothing day. And it's really funny that we had to create a movement to do this, because when you think about it, there are very few days where you don't buy anything. And it's just something that you do every single day. You buy coffee, you buy a chocolate bar, you buy a magazine. And the idea of not consuming is becoming kind of radical, really.
Yeah, now with shows and TV, because everyone's got the PVRs and stuff, they've actually started putting product placement into the shows.
Mm.
And you look, it's like, oh, obviously that company is a sponsor of the show because it's so blatantly there for you to see.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I think the eco-friendly movement went as well, because we as a society tend to identify so strongly with what we buy rather than what we do. That's where we went with eco-friendly living as well, is that we're starting to tell people that we're eco-friendly based on what we're buying. So we're walking around, it's like, oh, look at my cloth bag and look at my reusable travel mug and look at my, you know, scarf that was knitted out of upcycled this. But it would have been better maybe if we didn't have to buy a travel mug at all. We could have just used a jar that we already had. Or, you know, did we need that cloth bag, or could we have just used that kind of untrendy one that we got from the library or whatever. Like, we are identifying by what we buy rather than what we do. And I think focusing on what we're doing is a way better productive place to put our energy, but it's more challenging to do because you don't get the outside recognition for it. And how do people know that we're eco-friendly if we're not advertising it, right?
Yeah, and those travel mugs are so pretty and expensive. You can spend $30 or $40 on one, and then you look and you've got 18 in your cupboard.
Yeah, and none of them have lids, and some of them break, and some of them spill, and so you buy another one, and it's like, travel mugs are now the problem. Like, we have too many travel mugs. We just, like, I don't know, we keep thinking that we're solving problems, but we create four more.
Well, this was an interesting thing, speaking about the media and all of that, and shaping what we desire and our culture so much. Engagement rings
mm-hmm.
weren't traditionally diamond.
No, it's such a recent thing. And this is such a touchy topic. And I try and approach this really sensitively because I don't want to crap all over somebody's engagement. And I'm so happy for people when they get engaged. It's such a huge moment in their lives that, you know, if one of my best friends got engaged and showed me her diamond ring, I would never start being like, do you know that diamonds are the most popular gemstone in the world and they're practically worthless except for this campaign by De Beers? Like, I would never launch into that lecture. But I do think that it's important that we realize that this is a very recent thing. Diamonds as engagement rings are very, very recent in terms of our culture needing that as a symbol of being engaged. And the impact of those diamonds is huge, and it's horrific. If you take 5 minutes and you do some research, there's no way you would ever want that on your hand as a symbol of love. You get into it and it is really disturbing. So I talk about that a little bit in the book and just trying to encourage people to go beyond that, because to take it as a metaphor, the love stories that we love and the love stories that live on and that we aspire to and that we recreate in books and movies are love stories that are unique, and they're not your typical love story that everyone else has, and they go above and beyond. They do something different. And this is a huge opportunity for you to start your relationship with this person as your husband or wife with something different and something that you're not just buying because you're told you have to buy, and you're not spending, you know, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars that you might not really be comfortably able to afford on this ring that you want just because you've been told to want it, right? So there are so many options out there now, and this is a good part of green living becoming more popular, is that there are more eco-friendly options for rings. You can get rings made of a stone that's significant to you. So if you have a stone that you picked up from your first date, they can make that into a ring. You could get a ring made from recycled gold. You could get a ring made from your birthstone, you know, a grandma's ring that you could get remade into something. Like, there's so many options to go above and beyond the diamond that it's worth looking at anyways. And it's worth educating yourself about where a diamond comes from and what kind of price tag, not just financial, but also human rights. I mean, the trail that it leaves, it is worth looking into and making your decision from there, just because it is something that it does matter, really.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell anyone not to buy diamonds. I think they're so pretty and I love things that are sparkly. But honestly, when I get engaged, when I've been in relationships where we've been talking about moving in that direction, I've always said, you know what, I don't want an expensive ring. I'd rather have a home to live in. You know, like, don't spend $10,000 on a ring for me.
Mm-hmm.
Let's use
it
as a down
payment. I mean, everyone has their own ideas. And I think it's something, when my husband and I got engaged, I had a pearl ring, which I think used to be the engagement ring. I think pearls were the engagement ring back in the day because they were so rare before diamonds came along. So I got a pearl ring because it was something that my grandmother had always given pearls to me and it was significant. And then for our wedding bands, we had them made out of recycled gold. So it kind of felt like it was something that we both wanted that was still beautiful and that signify. I mean, you wear a ring on your left hand, you ring that finger, the engagement finger on your left hand, people are going to understand what it means. It doesn't necessarily have to be a diamond. But there are options too, even if you want a diamond. You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting a diamond. They are gorgeous and they are so pervasive that if you want one, you can find one that's responsibly sourced and that's ethically mined, and you can do that. But it's worth looking into and just sort of making that choice and making it really conscious, because if this is being taken as a symbol of your love, you want it to be symbolizing the right thing.
Or I just thought of this, you could even get a diamond secondhand.
Totally, yeah. And that's kind of the thing that people talk about when they talk about the value of diamonds. They say, have you ever tried to sell a diamond? Like, you'll never get more than half of what you paid for it. So yeah, you can find a secondhand diamond. I mean, vintage stores, you can find secondhand diamonds. And I mean, they're just beautiful. Some of the old, like, vintage designs are just gorgeous.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Unearthing the depths of contemporary cassettes and vinyl undergrounds, ranging from DIY bedroom pop and garage rock all the way to harsh noise and, of course, drone. Pop Drone, every Wednesday at 10 to 11:30 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
My advice to young girls would be, go home after school.
We are speaking right now with Madeline Somerville. She's the author of All You Need Is Less, The Eco-Friendly Guide to Guilt-Free Green Living and Stress-Free Simplicity. Whew, that's a mouthful. And she is at sweetmadeline.ca. That's her blog. You can find her there. You can find me on YouTube is probably the easiest way to find me. YouTube.com/spiritualshow. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. So Madeline, we just have a few minutes left in the show. What do you think are some of the most important things you want to focus on for the last 10 minutes?
Well, the first thing that I would come up with is just the general tone of my book is to approach this in a really lighthearted, fun way. And I know that when we talk about environmentalism, there are so many overwhelming problems and the scope of it can sometimes feel just completely overwhelming. But I've tried to just take a tongue-in-cheek, funny approach to it. You can have an impact even while enjoying yourself. And so I just try and tell people to go through the book and find a place that you're excited about starting. And for everyone, this will be different. You know, if you enjoy cooking, this might be starting an herb garden instead of buying herbs from the grocery store. For me, it was cleaning. I really liked making my own cleaning products because it made me feel like I was like performing magic every time I made laundry detergent or something, like, presto, it worked. So if you can find some place that you're excited about beginning, that can take that initial intimidation out of it, because the hardest part is beginning. It's something new. You haven't done it before. There's strange ingredients. You have to follow a recipe. It feels challenging to start, but once you start it, it kind of snowballs from there. Like, once you start and you realize how easy it is and you realize the benefits of it and that everything works just as well or better than what you were using, that enthusiasm kind of propels you forward and you want to keep going with it. So just having that initial enthusiasm to get started is super important. And then the second thing I always try and remind people and myself is to be gentle. Be gentle with yourself in addition to being gentle with others. So let's cut out like the judgy eco-shaming. We're not better people if we recycle or worse people if we're not. And go easy on yourself too. If you're not doing 87 different things, but you are doing three. You know, if you've decided to compost and you've decided to buy some of your clothing secondhand, don't stress about the fact that, you know, you don't have solar panels, or don't stress about the times that you drive your car. I think it's really important to focus on the successes that we have and the positive things that we are doing, because as women, sometimes it can feel like going green is just another thing that's being heaped onto our plate. So we have to be beautiful, and we have to be thin, and we have to have immaculate homes, and now we have to do it in an eco-friendly way too. And I don't want it to become just another thing on the to-do list. So just to be gentle with yourself and take things one step at a time. Maybe as you run out of your window cleaner, you can swap it out for the window cleaning recipe in the book. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, when you run out of body lotion, maybe you can make your own. You don't need to tear through your house and do a complete 180 in a day, because I think that would be quite overwhelming and possibly not sustainable. So just about being gentle and taking it one step at a time.
Awesome. That I ran out of body lotion, and mostly I just use it on my hands. And I started just putting coconut oil on my hands.
It's so good. Your skin feels so absolutely amazing when you use coconut oil.
And then it's right there. I mean, you can, it's in the kitchen. You just grab a scoop and put it in a little jar beside my bed, and it's easy.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I mean, you can't get much more simple than that. I mean, you could eat it. So you know that it's natural, right? You know that you're not slathering yourself in something weird that is going to cause problems down the line. I used to do that in BC. In Alberta, it's so dry that I needed to start making my own lotion. So I've got a recipe on my blog for lotion that just uses olive oil, beeswax, and water. And that's been working really, really well, just because it is so dry here that coconut oil just wasn't doing the trick for me anymore. But yeah, if you can just go to simple oils to moisturize, I mean, just amazing.
So I guess the beeswax kind of seals the moisture in?
I think so, yeah. And it just creates a more emollient cream. Like, it just makes it a little bit thicker. And so if you, I used to put it in the fridge in the summer because it was so hot here. It'd be like this nice creamy lotion. And I mean, you can add essential oils to it too, so it has a scent to it if you like that. But I'm totally hooked on it. I can't believe it took me this long to make lotion. It took moving to Alberta to make lotion.
Okay, well, I want to talk a little bit just before the end of the show. You were talking about the cleaners and how that was one of the things you're most passionate about. And we were talking about bleach earlier, and you mentioned vinegar. And now I feel like if it can't rip the skin off your hand, it's not killing the germs.
Yeah, I know. You want something that's like, just kill it all. Yeah, there is a study that I reference in my book, and you can, I mean, go on the great Google and you can find it in a few seconds probably. But straight white vinegar, I don't know the exact statistics, but something like kills the same thing, like 99% of bacteria and 98% of germs and viruses or something like that. Like, it's virtually identical to, I don't know if I can say that popular cleaner that always references that, but it does sometimes feel like it needs to, you know, crash and burn the entire, if it doesn't burn your skin, how is it going to clean? But vinegar does the exact same thing without being toxic. So that's a really viable alternative. And there's also other things like tea tree oil, which are really antibacterial, have antibacterial properties without the negative side effects. So there are alternatives to just bleaching everything.
What about, I mean, I still, though, the vinegar, like I use vinegar in my kitchen. And I spray it, especially on the taps.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time you touch the tap, whatever germs are on your hand are on there, and then you wash your hands and then you turn off the tap.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always sort of, I spray it on to keep them clean, but I'm also worried if I'm really cleaning, if I'm really killing enough. But what about, like, what do you use to clean your toilet?
For my toilets, I use, this is kind of like, I don't use a toilet brush. I just use rubber gloves and I get in there. Like, I think you really just need to get in there. So get yourself a pair of rubber gloves. Mine are labeled toilet, so I don't use them for anything else because I don't want to be then doing dishes with my toilet gloves. You can't cross-contaminate. So
No.
I have a separate pair of gloves. I use baking soda, cast iron soap, and a sponge or a dish rag that I can wash in a sanitized cycle. And I just get in there because that way you can get under the rim. You can actually scrub. The baking soda is an abrasive. The soap is enough to clean it. Like, I think we really feel like we need to sanitize everything, but soap and water is just as effective as like a sanitizing spray for your hands. So it's good enough for your toilet too. You can use a few drops of essential oil if you want it to smell fresh. I don't usually, just because the soap that I'm using is enough for me. And by using the sponge, you can get into all those nooks and crannies you might miss. And then you don't have this toilet brush that's sitting beside your toilet that's like this big hunk of plastic just breeding bacteria. And if you've got kids, like, they are drawn to that thing like it's a magnet. So if I don't have that sitting there, that's one less germy place in my home that I have to worry about. So get some rubber gloves and get in there.
Wow. That's, yeah. Well, definitely don't use the same rubber gloves. I like that. I'm afraid.
I know. See, we're so germ-phobic. Don't be germ-phobic. Like, there, look it up as well. There's a study that talks about, it's kind of like the backlash that we're having to those hand sanitizers. And there was a study published by, I think, the FDA that was talking about how soap and water is just as effective as antibacterial hand soap. And it doesn't have any of the negative side effects. Like, we have been, it's ingrained in us that you need to, like, sanitize, but we don't. Soap and water is enough.
It can't be. I can't. Commercials have told
She's like,
me.
No, I need it.
If I don't use hand sanitizer and, you know, scour myself with bleach, I'm going to get Ebola and E. coli.
You shower in bleach, Marie, be honest.
Well, the water has chlorine in it.
I know. It's just everywhere. I'm going to send, I'll send you the two links that I talked about, and I'll see if I can convert you. But I totally get it. Like, it's something that's ingrained in us. And I'm not a huge germ person, which is probably why I have an easier time with this, is that I'm a tidy person, but I'm not phobic about germs. And so it's something that's easier for me to kind of like get in and adapt. But I totally understand, like, it's drilled into us that we need this. And every product has antibacterial this and antibacterial that. So it seems like, of course we need this. But think about 50 years ago, we didn't have this. Like, our grandmas didn't have Lysol. Our grandmas didn't have all this stuff. They used soap and water.
And they survived.
And they survived.
Amazing.
Can you believe it?
No, I can't.
We just need to go back to the grandma way of living with a few modern conveniences like the internet and celebrity gossip, and then we're good.
Well, one of the things, I'm really sensitive to chemical smells. Mm-hmm. So what happens is I just don't clean as often as I should. So the fact that I'm germ phobic, I probably would be doing a much better job cleaning with vinegar than not cleaning.
Totally. Although my husband makes a great show about, if I clean the bathrooms and because I use vinegar on like the bathroom taps and the mirrors and the countertops, he makes this great show of like, vinegar, like the vinegar smell, like he's so sensitive to it. So I don't know if that you might be sensitive like him as well. But yeah, the bleach smell cannot be good for you if you're sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sensitive to the vinegar smell a little bit, but it's not as extreme.
No,
as bleach.
It's not going to have that burning. Yeah. Just open a few windows and you'll be good.
Yeah. All right. Well, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being on the show, for writing the book, your blog, sweetmadeline.ca. Why should people visit that? What are they going to get?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know. This is such a crazy oversharing blog. It's more of a personal blog. It's where I put everything. I've got pictures of my daughter's birthday party. But I think it also helps to show that you don't have to have a really drab, austere, eco-friendly, Spartan lifestyle. Like, I had a waste-free birthday party for my daughter. We didn't use plastic plates or balloons, but it doesn't look boring or dull or bland. Like, you can live an eco-friendly life that's beautiful and colorful and still doesn't have a negative environmental impact. So it does give a bit of insight into that. But I also don't just natter on about green stuff. I talk about motherhood, and I talk about, you know, going back to work and finding conversations with my husband and all of the assorted minutia of my life that for some reason I feel compelled to overshare on the internet.
That's okay. I know all about oversharing on the internet.
It's an epidemic now. I don't know. Everyone has a blog.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Madeline. It's been such a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
So that was Madeline Somerville. She's the author of All You Need Is Less, the eco-friendly guide to guilt-free green living and stress-free simplicity. And you can find her at sweetmadeline.ca. And you can find me at spiritualshow.com or on YouTube at youtube.com/spiritualshow. This has been Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with me today. I want to send you lots and lots of love, just like every week. Be well. Namaste. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
Discordianism is a religion and subsequent philosophy.
The Discordian faith seem to be much more forgiving of the normals.
Yeah, the goddess of chaos. or archetypes or
ideas. It's a lot of really heavy interest in Discordianism.
Founded after the 1963 publication of its holy book, The Principia Discordia.
Discorder magazine has been Vancouver's longest running, free, badass, independent magazine, 35 years strong. On Saturday, July 21st, celebrate 401 issues of Discorder magazine with an all-ages party at Red Gate. There will be performances by BB, Francesca Belcourt, Morning Coup, and The New Rituals, guest hosted by Dunkin's Donuts, and featuring a photo booth, giant twister, and more. Tickets are a suggested donation of $10 and doors open at 8. For more information, visit citr.ca or find the event on Facebook. The 41st Vancouver Folk Music Festival comes to Jericho Beach Park July 13th to 15th. Experience the music of your world with artists from across North America and around the globe coming to make this the best weekend of your summer. Artists this year include the great Rye Cooter featuring the Hamiltones, the glorious Nico Case, the exciting